Sven, welcome to my podcast.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So I want to start off with an anecdote, or so something you said when you were at the TED Talk, I think in 2013, and you said you went into the office of the register, and you said you wanted to start, or you started a political party, and they basically laughed you out of the office. So do you remember this scene, and could you explain this maybe a little bit for the audience?
Yeah, so in 2009, when we started the Pirate Party in Luxembourg, we founded the party and asked, like, okay, what do we do to register as a party? You would guess that to be an official party, you need to register somewhere. So we looked into that, and we found out that normally the people responsible for the elections are the courts in Luxembourg. So we then went to visit the greffier en chef of the tribunal in Luxembourg City and knocked on the door, said, hi, we're here to register as a political party. I said, like, you don't need to register, but just out of curiosity, which party did you start? And like, I was 20-ish at that time, and proudly we told him, oh, look, we founded the Pirate Party. And at that moment, he started laughing uncontrollably. So that was like the moment I recognized, we did something, but maybe some people don't really see the value in that. Fast forward 15 years later, and our work in Parliament has spoken for itself.
Yeah, I was going to say fast forward to now. You know, from that moment, you actually made a mark, I think, in the political landscape in Luxembourg. So you described this moment. So what made you decide to start the political party? What was the thinking process?
So I came from a political family in the sense that we were never party political, but always political to help others in need, to speak our mind, to raise our voice when needed. So it became really important for me to do that as a student already. I joined the student council. In high school, I was part of a political movement, mostly for peace at that time. I still vividly remember throwing eggs at the US embassy for the decision of going to war in Afghanistan and Iraq. So I was very political and politically influenced at that time. So no wonder during my high school years, I joined a political party, which I became more and more disenchanted until 2009, when after the elections, they lost seats. And nonetheless, they claimed that they had won the election. Mm-hmm. And that's something I couldn't stand. And so I decided on that day that I wanted to look for something else. And so I Googled. Mm-hmm. 2009, we already had Google. Mm-hmm. Lucky me. So I found a Wikipedia page on parties in Luxembourg, and I checked them all up. And none of them really responded to my needs. The Christian Socialists, the CSV, was, too Christian for me. I'm not going to church. I'm identifying as an agnostic, so that was something I was struggling with. The liberals were far too economically liberal and not social liberal enough. The socialists, well, those were the guys that just lost the election and claimed to have won it. The Greens were at that point too radical for me. And while I agree that climate is a very, very important issue, that focus on only the climate was not what I was looking for at that time. And on the fringes, I couldn't identify myself with the fringes. So what do you do? Well, you Google, what else could I do? And then you found that wiki page where people were discussing creating a pirate party. And so I started contributing to, in a very nerdy way, to a discussion forum in Wikipedia syntax, which is something most people don't read.
Did this happen in parallel with, because I know I lived in Germany at the time, and I kind of a little bit remember the emergence of the Pirate Party in Germany. Was this parallel with the developments in Germany, or was this a little bit later or independent of the German party?
So the German party was already founded. That was founded in 2007, if I remember correctly. So, but they had not yet had any electoral successes. So it was mostly nerds talking amongst each other. This quickly changed because here in Luxembourg, from the get-go, we had people that were digitally inclined, but nonetheless came from all walks of life. People that studied law, people that came from the tech scene, but also people coming from the social sector, which immediately meant that the party had a focus that went beyond only tech issues. Obviously, those were the most important issues at the beginning. And 3 months later, we just wanted to have a get together, meet, drink some beers, and discuss whether we wanted to found a party. We announced that on the mailing list, and suddenly we get messages from Germany and Switzerland, where the Pirate Party already existed, that they would join us for our founding meeting. And we didn't plan on founding a party. But through that accident in miscommunication, mistranslation, whatever, we suddenly decided, well, if they believe we'll found a party, well, there's no better day than today, so let's go.
So it wasn't planned. That was just
It
decided for.
wasn't planned at all. We were literally under the assumption until 2 weeks before our meeting that we wanted just to have a get together, drink some beers, and then through accidents of history, we decided to, yeah, let's go with it. Let's found a party.
So how was that in the beginning? Because I would imagine if I started a party, I would not know what I'm doing or where I want to go, especially if you're new. So how is that feeling being a brand new party and being thrown into the political gambit? You know, as you now you're a pol experienced politician, but imagine at the early 20s, that must have been quite interesting. Let's put it this way.
It was a lot of fun. You know, there's that word in party, which is party. And so you roll with the hits. You learn a lot while founding a newish party. You are learning a lot while trying to run that party, and you make a lot of mistakes. But somehow we managed to grow with it. Grow through making mistakes, grow through getting new people on board, integrating them into the party structure, and also negotiating the minefield that it is being in politics, even if you are not yet elected. So it was a lot of fun. We surprised everybody in 2013 when we managed to go beyond the 2% threshold that you need in an election to be considered, well, a serious contender for a party. And that for us was a sign that we were on the right path and that we should continue.
So, what do you subscribe your success in the sense that you made it into parliament? Because I did look into, because Pirate Party obviously exists in many other places in Europe. And interestingly enough, I saw they were also very successful in the Czech Republic, which I didn't know. But you and the Czech Republic, I think, stand out, I want to say, in terms of success in getting voted in. So, what do you ascribe that success from starting so in 2009 and now being in the parliament?
that we both fly under the Red Lion. no, jokes aside, there's a historical link between the Czech Republic and Luxembourg. If you are ever walking Karl's Bridge in Prague, you will see that the Luxembourgish Red Lion is on that bridge, and there's a reason for that, because Charles was of the House of Luxembourg, as was his father, John the Blind, Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire of Germination. So we could inscribe that into that historical context, but that doesn't account for the successes of the Icelandic pirates, who also were in parliament for 3 terms. So I believe it's a question about being at the right place at the right time and offering a divergent view on how politics could be. There's a natural cycle of parties emerging and having success, and that's round about every 20 years. And so by pure coincidence and juvenile naivety, or however you would call it, we managed to found the party at the right moment in history and be ready when we needed it to be. And then obviously came all the challenges with being thrown into the deep end of being in parliament and actually having to take decisions, taking stands on many more issues than you ever expected. And that enabled us to show why pirates matter. One example I always use is we managed to change the constitution of Luxembourg. Not because we were nice, but simply because I was suing the government. By forcing the government towards more transparency, we managed to strengthen the role of individual MPs in parliament, which if I will never ever achieve anything else in my life, I can be happy to have made at least that smallish dent in the Luxembourg political universe. And that's how I see politics. It's not about being in favor or against everything or anything. It's about trying to make the world a better place.
You just spoke about transparency. So could you explain a little bit more? You said you forced the government to change the constitution and to be more transparent. Could you elaborate a little bit on this?
So a few years back, I was investigating a case where there were questions about the legality of certain moves of RTL Group compared to the contract they have with the Luxembourg government. And I knew that there was a contract. I knew that there were some conditions in that contract. But even as an MP, nobody wanted to show me the contract. And so I said, like, well, constitutionally, an MP is there to control the government. And it's the first power. It's not the second or third. It's the first authority as a legislator to control the government. So I asked the government very nicely, can you show me the contract? And very nicely, they said no. So more insistently, I asked again. And even more insistently, they said no. So repeat that two more times, and I end up with a situation where I say, like, this can't be the case. You can't spend 10 million a year on a private company, and Parliament is not allowed to see whether that company is respecting the contract that they have with the Luxembourg government.
Just a clarification question. At the time, did the Constitution say that the government is allowed to not provide that information?
The Constitution didn't say anything. The Constitution just said, like, the government action is controlled by Parliament.
Okay.
Whatever that means. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, it's clearly written that Parliament has the right to ask for any documents of the government.
So it's more like an addition to the Constitution.
While we did a whole constitutional reform, and during that reform, it has been added to the Constitution.
Okay.
And so I sued. I said, like, and then the question was, where will I sue? Mm-hmm. So I argued this is an administrative decision that the government took by not giving me access.
Yeah.
The government said, no, it's a political decision. So the courts can't be involved. There's a difference. If it's an administrative right to demand documents, then the courts can check whether the government was rightfully refusing access or not. If it's a purely political discussion, well, then the courts have nothing to say because that's a purely political domain between parliament and government. In the first instance, the courts didn't even want to listen to the arguments. They didn't look at the foundation of my argument. They essentially said, like, this is a political decision. It has no merit. We will not look. We will not look at it. Go away. Well, never tell a pirate to go away. Because I came back, I appealed that decision to the higher court, and they wrote a very interesting arrêt, as it's called, where they said, well, first of all, this is an administrative question because the Constitution says Parliament controls government. and it's up to parliament to decide how that control looks.
And how that, and how money is distributed.
And it's the parliament has the power of the power of the purse. That's mm-hmm. A fundamental right of the first power. Mm-hmm. And so they said MP Clement has the right to require to request those documents. The second element then was, well, this is a contract that needs to be confidential. Mm-hmm. Can the government argue that confidentiality can be opposed vis-a-vis an MP? And there the courts then argued that no, they can't oppose it because he's a necessary confidant. Mm-hmm. And that's how I won that case and got access to the documents. And later, the constitution was amended during the constitutional reform to include a very specific language on MPs have the right to act to require documents. Well, Parliament has the right to require documents, and Parliament internally decided that every MP can address those requests mm-hmm. through the presidency of Parliament to the government. So there's now a clear institutional pathway, which, by the way, didn't mean that government was respecting those dispositions. That's why I'm currently, again, in court, asking for new documents. This time, the contract, the vaccine order forms for the COVID-19 vaccines. Mm-hmm. And just recently, so last week, before we recorded this, I won in the first instance. And the lower court this time has reaffirmed the right of MPs to require documents from the government.
Is this about the story of the COVID vaccines where they still sent us vaccines that we immediately destroy? Is that the story?
Oh, yeah. And it's a crazy story.
Okay.
I can't even get started on it because we will have a whole podcast only about that story. So beware.
Maybe we'll go at the... We try to like keep it at the borders of it, yeah.
So on a very high level, essentially, I know that we are still buying vaccines and sometimes they are getting destroyed at the factory because we don't use them. And we are paying for that. And I want to know who and why did we agree to such conditions?
Didn't they say, though, if I remember correctly, that the contract was made with the European Union? And therefore, it doesn't fall into your jurisdiction or Luxembourg's jurisdiction. If I remember that correctly, I'm not sure.
That's one of the arguments that they tried to advance. Okay. But they were sloppy when trying to hide their trail. Because essentially, the contract is signed between the European Commission and the companies. Mm-hmm. But the orders, so there are annexes to that contract, the vaccine order forms. And those orders are only signed by the national states and the companies. Mm-hmm. So essentially, there's a framework contract. And inside of that contract, the national orders are national responsibility. So in the end, it was up to Luxembourg whether they wanted to adhere to all those conditions or not, and how far. And so this and the lower court now has reaffirmed clearly that this is the case, that this is a national decision that falls under the control of the national parliament. And so I'm hoping that government doesn't appeal that decision, but I heard first indications that they might.
So you haven't seen the contract yet. You're still fighting to see the contract, if I understand that correctly.
I'm still fighting 3 years after I initially requested the contract.
So what does that tell you about the way, I mean, you've been in politics now for quite a long time. So how hard is it to accomplish? Because obviously you just told us that you are very proud of the reform in terms of transparency, but how hard is it to accomplish change in Luxembourg?
It's very difficult. It's something that is a very iterative process, but I'm very happy that we managed to achieve small but substantial changes. But it's changing the constitution, which is probably the biggest win. But also, like, sometimes even changing a comma for a semicolon mm-hmm. in a law has a huge impact. Mm-hmm. Another case where I personally managed to achieve a big win was during the debates on copyright reform. Mm-hmm. a European file, a European directive, so we had to transpose it. We also had to transpose it in line with the directive. But what we were able to manage to find a compromise on nationally was on how we define the granting of licenses to use snippets. So the Luxembourg approach, which is a very technical file, is now being cited in international jurisprudence on that legislators can, or and judges as a consequence, can consider a license being granted to Facebook or Meta, to Meta or to Twitter or to Google by the inclusion of specific tags in the HTML code. So if specific tags are present, the content included in those tags is being considered as a legally granted license to use those snippets, which was one of the questions on how to operationalize it. And I'm very happy that the small Luxembourg, that little opposition MP from that fringe party in that tiny little parliament of Luxembourg, managed to sneak a now European-wide cited definition of what is an implicit license of a snippet into law.
I think that I'm going to make the bridge here. I think this connects with, which I would say is part of your political agenda, is moving forward the area, I would call it the area of digitalization, the rapid technological change that we're witnessing right now. So how big of a part is that of your program right now? Because I know you have other concerns, right, which we're going to talk about later, like climate change, poverty and other things. But like, how much are you focusing on that right now moving forward?
The core of everything in the future and already today is digital. You can't talk about climate change or poverty without talking about digital. You just need to see how fast AI is changing our lives every day. So my goal is always to put the human at the center, but then also use the digital tools at our that are available to increase the quality of life of the individual human. So it's really a human-centric approach, but one that is supported by tech. And so we need to make sure that tech works for humans and not for only for the corporations. And one of the issues we currently see is that tech mostly works for corporations who have money to spend on lawyers, on drafting bills or drafting opinions so that they extract the most value out of consumer behavior, whereas the individuals are simply treated as a commodity in that machinery. So for me, it's really important that we come back to a human-centric approach where we are our, the bosses about our privacy, where we are responsible for our actions online. And I believe that digital tools are tools. They are not a panacea for anything. You can't solve human interaction issues by simply dropping tech on top of it. So if people believe like, oh yeah, we can have peace globally simply by using tech, I would argue that's absolutely bull. I believe we need tech to support human interactions, but they can't replace human interactions.
So there is a discussion right now that I followed is the, I want to say, the balance between innovation in AI and privacy. So, you know, there's lots of people that say, oh no, we in Europe and the European Union, we are too much focused on the privacy part and therefore drafting too many laws, kind of slowing down innovation, especially. And so they would compare it to the US, where obviously there's much less laws. I mean, talking about the EU AI Act, for example, which I think has been received quite critically from a lot of people in the business community. And, you know, they say or they argue that this is going to be bad for Europe long term in terms of competitiveness with big players such as the US or China and so on. So what is your perspective on that?
We miscommunicated what the AI Act is about. And we probably made, or those who wrote it, probably made mistakes in not granting wide enough or clear enough exceptions for smaller and medium-sized enterprises, in the sense that a startup that is bootstrapped has it much easier to launch an AI startup outside of the EU than in the EU. I'm talking about bootstrap companies. I'm talking about companies that are not funded.
Just for the audience, bootstrap means if you finance it all by yourself.
Exactly. So yeah. Companies with a very shoestring budget. Mm-hmm. And by the way, it's called bootstrap because of the history of Münchhausen.
So the Baron von Münchhausen.
Baron von Münchhausen.
Oh, okay.
By the way, who is buried in Luxembourg.
Oh, I did not know that. Okay.
In Lippertsberg.
Okay.
So the story about him is that he once sunk into some wetlands and mm-hmm. he pulled himself out by the shoestrings.
Right. Okay.
So he bootstrapped himself. Well, that's part of the story.
Okay, that's the history behind the word. Okay, I did not know that. That's interesting.
One part of the history. So a bootstrap company is one that tries to pull themselves out of whatever hole they are in by shoestrings. And that's, I think, something that is very difficult to do. And the AI Act is very bad at communicating how a small company can comply or whether they have to comply. Where I disagree is that it's any hindrance for a multi-billion dollar or euro company. Honestly, OpenAI doesn't want to comply with the AI Act because then they would need to work ethically. Mm-hmm. And ethics is something that many major companies simply don't want to do. It's not that they can't do it, it's simply they might make slightly less money than the obscene amounts that they are currently doing.
Okay, so you're saying it's hurting specifically small and medium-sized businesses in particular areas, but not so much the big players.
The big players have the money to spend on lawyers, and they are doing that anyway, and they are already lobbying on all of those issues anyway. They know what they do. Mm-hmm. So the compliance for a big company is something that it's much easier to do than for a small company. So we need to drastically in Europe cut the red tape for smaller businesses, for startups. It is bizarre to see how many paperworks you need to fill to start a company. We need to find a way that we have the European Company Act where if you want to start up, and let's say up to 10 million euros in turnover per year, mm-hmm. 1 million, I don't care. Let's discuss the specificities later. But up to a certain amount of turnover, let's get rid of the requirement for a business license in every country you want to work with. Individual VAT registration in each country, which can cost an arm and a leg and takes up most of your time. Why not enabling banks to offer customers native IBAN numbers for each and every country from one central point of contact? Why not enable companies to sell across whole of Europe from day one? Currently, if you are a small seller, you need to track 27 different legislations on VAT. If you are selling to the US, you are tracking one federal mandate. And, well, if you're selling physical products, you need to track sales tax in the different states. But in Europe, you need to be aware of the different thresholds per country. Mm-hmm. Look, I'm a startup entrepreneur. We regularly get emails from Stripe telling us, beware, you are approaching a compliance threshold for France, Portugal, Belgium, Germany. So that means that we then need to lose time on finding out how does the VAT system work in Portugal, in France, in Germany, in Belgium. And in the end, you might end up in being registered in 27 countries to pay what is due. But the problem is you need to figure out how much you owe and how to do it. We don't have a common VAT regime for startups, which we should have. We don't have a Common Company Act, which we should have. So we need to enable small companies to simply get started and figure out the complexities once they have the money to do so. So why? As long as an owner doesn't pay themselves a salary and can't because they don't earn enough money, why should they spend thousands of euros on accountants and notaries just to be able to start their company? I don't get it. We talked about the 1 euro company, mm-hmm. the 1 euro, 1 day, and so on, company, the SRLS. Well, it never took off as we expected. Why? Because in the end, the banks are still asking for more proof.
Yeah, I was going to say, what is the reason for this red tape and this bloated bureaucracy, I guess? And I think there's another issue which commonly comes up, which is that apparently it's very hard for businesses to open bank accounts for some reason, which it seems strange in a country like Luxembourg. So what, in your opinion, what are the reasons behind this? Because this criticism comes up quite often, and it seems there's really not much movement in that sense.
So let's start with the red tape in general, and then I'm mm-hmm. pivoting to the bank accounts. Red tape, it's a difference between being risk positive or risk averse. Europe has a history of being risk averse when it comes to companies. Let's have all your ducks in a row. Let's make sure that you have all the proper licenses, permits, and so on before you even get started. You need to have specific licenses for a whole lot of businesses that make sense. And then you have a whole lot of licenses that make absolutely no sense in a digital world. Like, I agree that in order to be a hairdresser, you should have a license. You should be a licensed hairdresser. By the way, that's not different in the United States either.
Sure.
If you want to be a mason, well, you should have an understanding of masonry because you don't want to have walls crumbling. Mm-hmm. But if you are building digital tools, why do you need a business permit that essentially only says, well, did you finish high school? Mm-hmm. So if you finish a certain level of schooling, you are automatically granted the permits, but you still need to request them mm-hmm. and prove that you followed the schools and so on. But that makes it impossible for people that had difficulties in school, as an example, to launch their business. It takes time away. It costs money. It costs headaches. So I believe we should simplify the formation of businesses. Why do we need to have statutes, even for an SRL, that go through a notary? Mm-hmm. It's a company that can be founded with a core capital of 12,500 euros. And then you ask or require them to immediately pay a few thousand bucks for a notary. That's just creating jobs for notaries. Yeah. It's not creating any value in the value chain of that company. The same is true for VAT registration, accounting. Why can't we simplify that? Mm-hmm. So other countries have different approaches, and they clearly say, like, okay, up to a certain standard, you just need to like follow basic accounting rules, cash in, cash out, and you can declare that easily on your personal tax declaration or on a simplified tax declaration. We force every company, independently of their turnover, to file according to double accounting standards. This makes sense if we can enable a whole value chain around them that provides that, but we are not doing that. And again, we are not competitive when it comes to launching startups, simply because the cost of launching companies is too high, and we are losing too much time in Europe as a whole with compliance. So we need to slash red tape for small to medium-sized companies, especially for startups. Like, having some rule that for the first 2 years, 3 years, or until you reach a certain level of turnover, well, certain rules don't need to apply. You can comply with them already, but if you can't, you can't. The same is true for Social Security. Look, if I were to found a company and I don't have any other employment, as the manager, as the director of the company, I need to register with Social Security, and I need to prepay 25%, which is the Social Security cost in Luxembourg, 25% on minimum wage to the Social Security, whether I earn that money or not. There are ways to pay less, but you need to know about it, mm-hmm. and you need to take care of it. So essentially, you start your company, you have not rented an office, you have not paid an accountant, and you are already spending 750 euros a month on Social Security. There are countries where with 750 euros a month you can live. In Luxembourg, that's the minimum to pay in order to run a business. Mm-hmm. So next to your cost of living, you also need to pay, you need to earn those 750 euros. So it makes it much more difficult in Luxembourg to start a company, especially for small and medium-sized companies that want to bootstrap. Mm-hmm. And then you don't even have a bank account yet. You would say Luxembourg, that's banking.
Paradise. You should go into a bank, get an account and be done in 5 minutes, in theory.
You would think so.
Yeah.
So the problem is, given that Luxembourg was on grey lists, black lists and so on, our banks are gold plating essentially KYC AML regulations. But at the same time, don't bat an eye when Caritas is losing 61.
What does that mean when you say gold plating KYC regulation?
Well, they are asking for more than they probably need to. Mm-hmm. They want to eliminate the last remnant of risk. And again, it's the risk aversity versus a certain acknowledgement that risk is part of existing.
Sure.
So it might simply be asking for more proof of residence than like what most international banks do, like a bill of your energy supplier.
Sure. With your address on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, here you might be asked, oh no, you need to provide a certificate from your municipality. Mm-hmm. If you're a foreign born entrepreneur, you might not have the documents in a language that they understand. So you need to translate them. You need to provide them. So you might need to provide a CV. You might need to provide guarantees, and all of that costs the bank. So the banks are not interested in opening bank accounts for bootstrap companies because the cost operating that account is far too high compared to what they can earn on it.
Okay.
So we now see the bizarre situation that, and then Luxembourg was never a retail bank paradise. Retail banking in Luxembourg is underdeveloped compared to the rest of the world.
It was most investing and funds.
It's the investment banking and it's private banking. Mm-hmm. So if you are above the threshold of private banking, no worries, they will open bank accounts for you.
Yeah, they'll roll out the red carpet for you. Yeah,
you'll get invitations to the nicest concerts and dinner parties, and then they will open a bank account. But beware, if you are just a holdco and they know that you are not spending enough money in banking services, because you just need the bank account to essentially for operating expenses, they will not make money on you. So they would even be losing money on you, so they are not doing it, mm-hmm. which rationally makes absolute sense.
Sure,
but from a business perspective,
yeah.
It's the economic perspective is absolutely disastrous for the country. So we now need to find a way to either subsidize that cost of maintaining bank accounts to enable startups to come to Luxembourg and have bank accounts, or we need to accept that that might be a business that the Luxembourgish banks have lost out on.
Oh, so you would have to subsidize private businesses because the banks are not willing to maintain the service cost of the bank account.
That would be one option. Or the other option is, and that's the one I subscribe to, is, well, let's make it possible to start your company with a Revolut or a Wise bank account. And that's currently not possible because they are not emitting the certificate of blocking the funds that the Luxembourgish notaries accept. So essentially, we see IBAN discrimination.
So businesses cannot use Revolut at this time in Luxembourg?
They can,
because I've used it,
but not for the creation of your company.
Oh, so there's still a regulation in place that prevents this from happening?
Well, no, and yes. The problem is the regulation says that the notary, when they open your SARL or SR, they need to have proof of funds through a certificat de blocage. So the bank needs to certify that they blocked the funds of the capital during the period between opening the bank account and the creation of the company with the notary. And only after that can the notary unblock the funds with the bank. Well, Revolut doesn't care for that quirk in Luxembourg law.
Okay.
So they don't want to comply with that. They say, like, we can show you a proof of funds, but we are not blocking them for
So they're not going through that hassle process because that's not worth for them. It's not worth it.
No, the market is way too small.
So
in the end, you need a Luxembourgish bank account that proves that you have the funds to be able to open your company. And so there are workarounds. I know of one company that sells you that service for the privilege of 500 euros a month. Well, now we have social security, 750 euros a month, 500 euros a month to create my bank account. Well, after 3 months, I'm already down 3K just for the pleasure of launching my company. And I have not yet paid a notary 1,000 euros, at least, maybe 1,500, 2,000. I have not yet paid an accountant. I have not yet paid for rent of an office. So starting a company, especially for startups, it's too expensive in Luxembourg. And that's the main issue we are currently facing. If we want to be Startup Luxembourg, Startup Nation,
so
we need to address that.
When I see the party that is in power, when I see them talking about the startups, you'd have the impression that Luxembourg is a startup paradise. You know, we have so many initiatives and everything is so good. Everything is so great. So how do you, I would assume people read this, they might believe it. So what are your thoughts on, you know, that some people proclaim that we are a great place for startups right now?
Oh, we are a great place if you're funded. If you don't care for a few thousand euros in costs and overhead, and you don't need to turn around every dime, well, then we are a great place. So that's why we see they try to attract mostly funded startups. VC funded startups in stages where they have enough money.
So what I've been reported is a lot of startups, they might get even funded in the beginning, but a lot of time what happens is they run out of money. So that when the second round of funding comes around, they're already out of cash and they go out of business. Is that something that you noticed as well?
I've seen a lot of companies not making it in the medium term. I'm not even talking about the long term, but simply the medium term where we see. But that might also be a lack of product market fit. So I don't want to say that's due to Luxembourg. That might simply be due to not achieving product market fit quickly enough, but that obviously also is linked to the cost of running your business in Luxembourg. And so if I look at taxx.lu, which is my most successful venture so far, we bootstrapped it. We very late looked for outside funding to accelerate growth. We are very happy with where that left us in the end. That being said, I believe it is possible. We have proven it. With salary.lu, we are proving it again. And we've shown with a dedicated team, and I can only applaud because as a politician, I can't do the operational thing at the moment, that the team is proving again and again that you can run even bootstrapped startups in Luxembourg and that it's absolutely doable. And that you can overcome even hurdles of KYC if you have a PEP on board. And I'm probably more of a problem as a political exposed person than I'm an advantage when it comes to that, because once you have that label, politically exposed person, banks will look twice before touching you. So the teams have proven that it's doable to run a startup. A profitable bootstrapped startup in Luxembourg. Now, do I understand that Luxembourg has issues? Yes, as I mentioned, there are a lot of issues and we need to address that. We need to address the red tape. We need to address the cost of running a startup in the first months, in the first years. We need to address the reasons why startups go bankrupt. And that's because they don't understand CCSS, because they don't understand VAT in Luxembourg, because they don't understand all of the details that they need to address. So, yeah, we need to simplify running startups, especially smaller ones in Luxembourg. And then the question is, which startup nation do we want to be? That scrappy and hungry young startup nation that tries to grow and pull themselves out on the shoestrings? Or do we want to be that concrete glass tower startup nation where we are only attracting well-funded startups in the fintech space that only create white-collar jobs and are essentially financed by the banks, which we already have? Do we want to become even more dependent on the banking sector, or do we really want to address issues that are targeting the real economy? Well, my choice over the last year has proven again and again that I believe in targeting issues that people have on a daily basis, and that we want to simplify their administrative burden as much as possible to increase their productivity. And that's what my startups over the last years have been about.
Talking about the real economy, when I was going through a recent interview of you, you laid out some of the core agendas you had. And I was so surprised to see something that I don't think nobody associates with Luxembourg, which is poverty. You know, because a small anecdote, when I lived in the US, everybody, and I told them I'm from Luxembourg, everyone was, you have the highest GDP in the world, and you must be swim, you know, when you wake up, you know, you must like Dagobert Duck, you know, you must swim in money, you know, and it's like, so the perception is Luxembourg is very rich, right? So, but you kind of pointed out a little bit of different reality. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
The reality in Luxembourg is that 1 in 5 children live below the poverty rate. 1 in 5. That means that if you go to a typical classroom, you can count the children that will have trouble that evening to have a proper dinner. And that's the reality of Luxembourg. We are a country with an extremely high cost of living, which is not aligned, especially when you take into account housing costs, with the salaries that we earn. GDP per capita is absolutely the wrong indicator in a country that generates about a third of its GDP through cross-border workers. There's a reason why the gross national income is a much better indicator to where we stand, and if we are counting for that, we are not number one by far. So, going back to that number of 1 in 5, Luxembourg is, the reality is not black and white. When I was a child, my parents divorced, and I remember very precisely my mom not going to the dentist so that we could buy new clothes. My mom not getting glasses, which she should probably have gotten much way earlier than she finally did, so that we could get glasses, or that we could go on that school trip. And that's coming from the outside, pretty standard middle-class family. Mm-hmm. So talking about all of those issues, I feel a personal connection to that. I don't claim to have ever experienced absolute poverty, mm-hmm. by far not. I was always from a privileged upbringing. But even with a privileged upbringing, even by not experiencing absolute poverty in Luxembourg, that border, that fringe between having a decent life and experiencing hardship is very narrow. And it's far too easy to cross it into the wrong direction. And it's much, much harder to cross it into the right direction. So, given that personal history, for me, it's obvious that we need to address rising inequality.
How would you change this? What would you do?
Well, first of all, we need to have a paradigm shift when it comes to housing. Mm-hmm. Luxembourg always has been a country of owners. We need to realize that in most countries, if we want to bring down inequalities, we need to shift the focus to renters. We need to support them far more, also fiscally, which we're currently not doing enough. So if you own your house and you are neck deep in debt, your interest payments are essentially subsidized through your tax return. If you're renting and you are spending less, you get absolutely no help at all. So we need to find ways to subsidize renters more than we currently do with owners. Mm-hmm. And maybe we need to shift who gets the tax benefits and who doesn't. On the other hand, we need to address cost of living in general. Most people that already struggle live farther away from Luxembourg City or farther away from their job. Mm-hmm. They very often work atypical hours. So all the measures that we claim should help them, like free public transportation, actually doesn't help them. So we need to be much more targeted when it comes to helping people. We need to stop going across the country with a hose, and we need to target public help much more specifically. To give you an example, currently the energy costs break that we have, that we voted in Parliament, is applied up to a consumption of 25,000 kilowatt hours per year per household. Mm-hmm. That includes people who heat their outdoor pool. So we are subsidizing people with taxpayers' money to heat their outdoor pool,
yeah,
or to run a sauna in their basement.
That's tax money well spent.
That's tax money absolutely well spent. And mm-hmm. Sorry for my sarcasm, but it's I can't stand that we have one in five children having trouble getting three meals a day at the same time where we spend taxpayer money on heating outdoor pools, or where we are subsidizing too expensive company cars. I believe we could be far more targeted when it comes to using tax benefits, tax credits, when it comes to social security support, and we are not doing enough. So that's part of the answer. I could go into many, many more very specific details, and as very often there are even, again, a link back to the digitalization. There are subsidies, aids that you can get, but you need to request them. And I don't understand why we can't automate that. Let's get people a letter every year where the government tells them, according to our data, you are eligible for the following aids. If you send back this letter, you immediately apply for all of them. And by the way, the following ones could be, you could be eligible for them according to what we know, but we need more proof that you are eligible. Please provide the following data and we can tell you whether you are eligible. Or please call the following number and make an appointment to check whether you are eligible. Why is that so difficult?
I think it's probably also a sort of non-effectiveness in the government when it comes to this digital infrastructure as well, communicating with people digitally. And I mean, there's so many cases. For example, if you want to, if you go to the doctor, you still have to mail in. I think they're changing that now, but it used to be.
Today I had a meeting. Sorry, I have to interrupt you. Today I had a meeting with the pharmacists of Luxembourg.
Uh-huh.
So when you go to your pharmacy, you will give them your prescription. Mm-hmm. They will then, once a month, every pharmacist, there are 102 in Luxembourg, mm-hmm. needs to box all of those prescriptions up.
Okay.
That's 4 to 5 boxes per pharmacy.
And send them in by mail.
And drive them personally to the CNS.
Yeah.
Where they need to arrive by the 10th of the month.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And you need to deliver them between 9 and 12:30.
But how is that possible that we are still in the dark ages like that?
It gets even better. You also need to add a CD.
A CD?
A CD. Not a USB stick,
okay.
A CD.
Yeah, yeah.
the output of your cash register.
Wow. A CD. I have not seen a CD in like 10 years, but okay.
Yeah, they're not even produced anymore.
No, they're not. No.
So we now force 102 pharmacists to deliver by hand each month somewhere between 400 and 600 boxes of paperwork, including 102 CDs, to the CNS. So if you complain about your...
Now I feel a little bit better thinking about the pharmacy, what they have to go through. But how is this possible? Like in 2025?
Well, I asked the same question yesterday in the Committee on Institutions. We discussed how to reform the electoral law, and one of the proposals I made was, well, I've seen it in other countries like Georgia or Bosnia Herzegovina, like. Very developed countries.
Yes, one of the most developed countries in Europe, yes.
Yeah, where you can go essentially to whatever polling station and you just like swipe your ID card or your passport where you have that machine readable zone and it doesn't real time check whether you already voted or not and if you are eligible to vote in that district. So why can't we do that in Luxembourg? I asked like, we have four districts. We could essentially say, you can go to whatever polling booth, a polling station you want, as long as it's in your district. Today, you have to go to the polling station that you are living, where they ask you to come. Yeah, you could do way more things. We could have bigger polling stations where more people could vote. We could have polling stations on the parking lot of your local supermarket. But no, that's currently not possible. And you know why? Because in 2025, the argument was not every polling station has access to internet. We are 2025. The next elections are 2028. I said, like, I hope that at least in 2028 they will have. And the answer is, no, probably not. Or will you pay for it, Mr. Clement? I was like, for God's sake, we are talking about 2028 that the polling stations in Luxembourg, the country with the highest GDP per capita, don't have access to internet. While countries like Georgia and Bosnia-Herzegovina are running their elections digitally, that can't be the case. And that simply shows that a few politicians are still so stuck in the past, so stuck in the analog world, that we need to have reform, that we need to rethink how we do business in Luxembourg instead of simply iterating slightly on what worked in the past.
But is it also that people are too comfortable in Luxembourg sometimes? It's like there's no, you know, so they never encountered any hardship. You know, maybe they work in the public sector forever and, you know, it's fine. They earn their money. They can go to vacation twice a year. So it's just a mentally, you know, it's just such a isolate silo thinking that, you know, oh, whatever, you know, we're fine, you know, we'll be fine also in 10 years, which I'm not sure we will be if we keep this thinking, I would say.
I would argue that there are a few elements to be considered. One of them is that the socio-demographic of the electorate is not conducive to change.
Well, that's a roundabout way to say it, yeah.
Over 50% of the electorate depend for their monthly income, directly or indirectly, on the state, whether it's through pensions or because they work for the government. So how do you expect those voters to vote against their own interest when it comes to change?
You don't.
So why do you think that there was such a strong rejection of allowing non-Luxembourgers to vote? Because it would have upended the status quo. The employed people in the private sector would have won way more weight in the electoral system than they currently have. If I say that over 50% of the electorate directly or indirectly depend on the state, that means that the interest of maintaining a status quo is very strong, and that the interest of supporting companies or the productive sector that creates jobs is limited to those that earn money there. It's not malice, I would say. It's not incompetence, I would say. It is purely ignorance mm-hmm. of the reality in the productive economy.
Yeah, I think that's what I was trying to say, but you were articulating it way better. So if I
understand, that's why I'm a politician.
That's why you're a politician. There you go. I thank you a lot. But isn't that because another item that you listed in one of your priorities was the political disillusionment that's happening right now? So does that play into this a little bit? There's some sort of fatigue that people have towards politics, politicians. So how do you plan on engaging people and maybe move past this disillusionment that many people have?
Well, first of all, you need to show that politicians are normally human beings. Mm. And that means that we can't have a parliament that is made up only of public servants. We need more entrepreneurs in parliament. We need more employees in parliament. We need more people from the productive industries in parliament, whether it's industry, agriculture, viticulture, even from the tech sector. We are currently heavily dominated by public servants. And politics is mostly something where people from the same families appear again and again.
In that context, you said, and I want to list a quote that you said. You said, nepotism in Luxembourg only gets somewhere if you know someone needs to stop. So is that something that is related to your argument?
I would say yes.
That's what you said. I'm quoting you here.
And I'm astonished where you found all my quotes. But
there you go. Yeah.
Good preparation. No, obviously it's the situation in Luxembourg is that many politicians come from families that already had politicians. So why should they change? Why should they be the bringer of change? If you are running for a party that has a 100-year history, do you expect that party to radically shift the paradigm? Or do you think that they will defend until the last bullet whatever they decided 20 or 30 years ago?
I feel like you're talking about CSV.
No, but
you talk about
the
general.
Is the same. Let's talk about the pension reform. The last pension reform was 2012 under Masti Bartolomeo as the minister. Now Masti Bartolomeo is in parliament and still defends his pension reform. Instead of having a radical paradigm shift on how pensions will be financed in the future, we are still having the same debates then 13 years ago. And why is that? Because the same people are still advocating for their solutions to a problem that has evolved. And yes, his reform in 2012 might have been the reform that was possible in 2012. But we are not 2012 anymore. And so parties need to evolve with time. And I don't see how you can evolve in if the same politicians stay in power, if the parties propose the same solutions to different problems, and if you don't find ways to enable paradigm shift. And earlier you asked me, how came it that the Pirate Party was successful? I believe that in 2018, people were to a certain extent fed up with hearing the same answers to different questions. And they wanted to hear new answers. And that's what we provided.
Do you, When you say the Pirate Party, you came up with a new answer. And I remember living in Germany when I was following the emergence of the Pirate Party in Germany. The established parties, what they would use as criticism generally is they would say, well, you're a one-issue voter party, right? So, but what is your stance on the big topics? I want to say on quotation, right? Like immigration, healthcare, social security, and so on, right? So the big topics that you see. So what is your response to, and I would assume people probably still criticize you, right? They'll try to pigeonhole you into this, oh, you're the digital guys, right? But you don't
Sometimes,
really,
but
yeah.
my answer would be, how much time do you have?
Right.
So let's have a 1 hour debate just on migration policy. I can give you probably more nuance on migration policy than the big parties. Why? Because actually we did deep dives on those issues because they are important and because a complex issue can't be solved with simple answers. Migration policy is linked to many, many aspects. First of all, it's cooperation policy. Can we help countries to develop much faster by enabling their citizens to stay put, by creating jobs locally? Like, I give you an example, and after that, we can talk health, we can talk whatever. But on migration, until 2030, it is estimated that 1.2 billion people will be under the age of 45. 1.2 billion,
Maybe,
but only
okay.
about 420 million jobs will be created for those people. So we have an employment gap of 780 million jobs.
Yeah.
If we don't create those jobs where the people are, people will move. They will migrate
Yeah.
to regions where they believe that they can find a job. So we have a choice. Do we want to stem a tide of 780 million people who can't find a job where they live? Or do we want to invest in creating jobs that enable decent living conditions
But isn't
where
that going to
people are?
be awfully difficult now, especially with the emergence of AI, which obviously is going to lead to job displacement? And there's a lot of discussion about universal income now because some people say, well, there will just not be enough jobs for people. So they're looking into alternatives such as universal income.
Well, we launched the UBI debate in 2013 already, so we can have a whole podcast about UBI as well. That's why I'm currently doing a podcast series with my wife about behind the scenes of politics, because that shows how different all of these issues are and then still interconnected. But AI will not displace the jobs that are needed in the global south. Those jobs, we are talking about basic jobs. We are talking about farmers, farming jobs, where you have a guarantee that you can, with climate change, still subsist. We talk about masons to build the housing for all those people that will need
But
housing
you
once
don't
they
think
leave
this could be
their
done by
families.
machines or AI at some point?
It might, but at what cost? And
I don't know. I'm just saying, Gary, if
if
there
we
is
are
a
looking.
possibility, you
If
know,
we are
it.
look, if history is any teacher for the present, and I'm cautious
You're
about
gonna go the Industrial Revolution argument, probably.
that, we always saw more jobs coming out of technological turmoil. And why? We just saw shifts, but productivity rose, and so people had more money to spend. And so people could essentially spend it on new things that we then needed to produce. So, yeah, that's how we ended up mostly with new jobs. That's a very basic economic explanation to the process of to why, with the Industrial Revolution, we lost some jobs, specific jobs,
We lost the
but
horses,
we lost the horses. And I think there's that famous Henry Ford quote: "If I would have asked my customers what they would have wanted, they would have told me faster horses. Nobody would have said a
A
car."
car, yeah.
And so the revolution is a revolution and not an evolution,
No, and so you're
because
saying
it
there's other jobs. You say
substitutes.
You're
Yeah.
saying essentially what you're saying is there will be other jobs that require a different expertise. While there might be some jobs that disappear, there will other jobs that will emerge.
Absolutely.
So I agree with you on that point, but I want to thank you for your time. It was a very, very interesting conversation. I know
Oh,
you're
my
very
pleasure.
busy. I know you're very busy, so I really appreciate you taking the time.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. And if there's anything, always feel free to reach out,
Of course, yeah, sure.
So
I'm always open for a good conversation.
yeah,
So,
back to
all
work.
right. That was a pleasure. Thank you, Sven. All
Thank
right.
you. You too.
Bye
Bye-bye.
bye.